And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's December the 14th, 348th day of the year. 17 days remain till the year's over with. On this day in history, in 557, Constantinople's is really damaged by an earthquake, which cracks the dome of Hagia Sophia. 835, Sweet Dew Incident. Emperor Wenzong of the Tang Dynasty conspires to kill the powerful eunuchs of the Tang court, but the plot is foiled. The eunuch is an individual missing certain equipment. 1287, St. Lucia's Flood. The Zuider Zee seawall in the Netherlands collapses. Over 50,000 people die in the flood. 1542, Princess Mary Stuart becomes Queen of the Scots. The age of 1 week on the death of her father, James V of Scotland. 1751, the Theresian Military Academy is founded in Wiener Neustadt, Austria. 1780, founding father Alexander Hamilton marries Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton at the Schuyler Mansion in Albany, New York. 1782, the Montgolfier brothers first test fly an unmanned hot air balloon in France. It floats almost 1.2 miles. 1812, the French invasion of Russia comes to an end as the remnants of the Grand Army are expelled from Russia. It was beaten not by the Russians, but by the weather. 1814, War of 1812, the Royal Navy seizes control of Lake Bourne in Louisiana. 1819, Alabama becomes the 22nd U.S. state. 1836, the Toledo War unofficially ends. Also known as the Great Toledo War, the Michigan-Ohio War, the Ohio-Michigan War. Almost bloodless boundary dispute between two states. That was Ohio and Michigan. Poor geographical understanding of Great Lakes helped produce the confusion. 1863, American Civil War. The Confederate victory under General Longstreet at the Battle of Bean Station in East Tennessee ends the Knoxville Campaign. But it doesn't achieve very much as Longstreet returns to Virginia the next spring. Had he followed up and capitalized on his victory, who knows what could have happened. 1896, the Glasgow Underground Railway is opened by the Glasgow District Subway Company. 1900, quantum mechanics. Max Planck presents a theoretical derivation of his black body radiation law at the Physics Society in Berlin. 1902, the Commercial Pacific Cable Company lays the first Pacific telegraph cable from San Francisco to Honolulu. 1903, the Wright brothers make their first attempt to fly with the Wright Flyer at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. 1907, the Thomas Lawson, the largest ever ship without a heat engine, runs aground and founders near the Hellweathers Reef within the island of Sicily in a gale. The pilot and 15 seamen on board die. 1909, New South Wales Premier Charles Wade signs the Seat of Government Surrender Act of 1909, formally completing the transfer of state land to the Commonwealth to create the Australian Capital Territory. 1911, Roland Amundsen's team, comprising himself, Olav Bajalan, Helmer Hansen, Sverre Hassel, and Oscar Wisting, become the first to reach the South Pole. 1913, Haruna, the fourth and last Congo-class ship, launches, begins eventually becoming one of the Japanese workhorses during World War I and World War II. 1914, Alessandro Di Latore and others found the Democratic Progressive Party at the Hotel Savoy in Buenos Aires, Argentina. 1918, Frederick Carl von Hessen, a German prince elected by the Parliament of Finland to become King Valino I renounces the Finnish throne. 1918, Portuguese President Sidonio Pais is assassinated. Also 1918, the 1918 United Kingdom general election occurs. That's the first one where women are permitted to vote. And the world paid a price. 1939, the Winter War. Soviet Union is expelled from the League of Nations for invading Finland. 1940, plutonium, also known as Pu-238, is first isolated at Berkeley, California. 1948, Thomas Goldsmith Jr. and Still Ray Mann are granted a patent for their cathode ray tube amusement device, the earliest known interactive electronic game. 1955, Albania, Austria, Bulgaria, Cambodia, Ceylon, Finland, Hungary, Ireland, Italy, Jordan, Laos, Libya, Nepal, Portugal, Romania, and Spain join the United Nations through the United Nations Security Council Resolution 109. 1958, the third Soviet Antarctic expedition becomes the first one to reach the South Pole of inaccessibility. 1960, Convention Against Discrimination in Education of UNESCO was adopted. 1962, NASA's Mariner 2 becomes the first spacecraft to fly by Venus. 1963, the dam containing the Baldwin Hills Reservoir burst, kills 5 people and damages hundreds of homes in Los Angeles, California. 1964, American Civil Rights Movement. Heart of Atlanta Motel versus the U.S. Supreme Court of the U.S. rules that Congress can use the Constitution's Commerce Clause to fight discrimination. 1971, Bangladesh Liberation War. Over 200 of East Pakistan's intellectuals are executed by the Pakistan Army and their local allies. The date is commemorated in Bangladesh as the Martyred Intellectuals Day. 1972, Apollo program. Eugene Cernan is the last person to walk on the moon after he and Harrison Smith complete the third and final extra vehicle activity of the Apollo 17 mission. Now remember, there is a rumor, never been substantiated, that there were at least 2 and possibly 3 missions after 17, but they were classified. 1981, Arab-Israeli conflict. Israel's Knesset ratifies the Golan Heights law, extending Israel law into the Golan Heights. 1985, Wilma Mankiller takes office as the first woman elected to serve as principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. 1992, War of Abkhazia, siege of Tverchely. A helicopter carrying evacuees from Vercelli is shot down, resulting in at least 52 deaths, including 25 children. The incident catalyzes more concerted Russian military intervention on behalf of Abkhazia. 1994, construction begins on the Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River. 1995, Yugoslav War. The Dayton Agreement signed in Paris by the leaders of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, Croatia, and Bosnia and Herzegovina. 1998, Yugoslav Wars. Yugoslav Army ambushes a group of Kosovo Liberation Army fighters attempting to smuggle weapons from Albania into Kosovo. 36 people are killed. 1999, torrential rains cause flash floods in Vargas, Venezuela. Results in tens of thousands of deaths, the destruction of thousands of homes, and complete collapse of the state's infrastructure. 2003, Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf narrowly escapes an assassination attempt. 2004, the Malilu Viaduct, the tallest bridge in the world, is formally inaugurated near Malilu in France. 2012, Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. 28 people, including the gunman, are killed in Sandy Hook, Connecticut. 2013, a reported coup attempt in South Sudan leads to continued fighting and hundreds of casualties. 2017, the Walt Disney Company announces it will acquire 21st Century Fox. including a 20th Century Fox movie studio for $52.4 billion. 2020, a total solar eclipse is visible from parts of the South Pacific, Southern South America, and the South Atlantic Ocean. Alrighty, let's see what else we might have. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian feast day, Fakwan, John of the Cross. John III of the Sadre in the Syriac Orthodox Church. Meltronian, Nicosius of Reims. Nematullah Kassab in the Maronite Church. Spyridon in the Western Church. Venatius Fortunatus. Alabama Day in Alabama. 47 Ronin Remembrance Day in Sengokuji in Tokyo. Martyred Intellectuals Day in Bangladesh. And Monkey Day. Let's see what else we might have. In 644, Uthman ibn Affan, a companion of Muhammad, appointed third caliph of Islam. In 867, Adrian II begins his reign as Catholic Pope. In 872, John VIII elected Catholic Pope. In 1124, Theobald Bacopacus elected Pope Cleisthenes II. He refuses the position. In 1575, the Polish Parliament elects István Báthory as King of Poland. In 1600, Oliveira del Norte sinks a Spanish galleon to San Diego at the Bay of Manila. 350 people die. In 1656, artificial pearls are first manufactured by M. Joaquin of Paris. They're made of gypsum pellets covered with fish scales. 1702, the 47 Ronin, that's leader is samurai, under the command of Ushi Kuranosuke, avenged the death of their master in Japan. 1708, Prosper Joyot de Crebillon's play, Electre, premieres in Paris. 1774, the first incident of the American Revolution. 400 New Hampshire militiamen successfully attack Fort William and Mary. 1782, Charleston, South Carolina is evacuated by the British. 1793, the first state road authorized from Frankfort, Kentucky to Cincinnati. 1798, David Wilkinson of Rhode Island patents a nut and bolt machine. 1812, the French invasion of Russia that I talked about earlier, led by Napoleon Bonaparte, officially ends on this date. The French lost as many as 530,000 men, mostly to the weather. 1862, the Battle of Kinston, fought on Lower County, North Carolina, begins. It's called the Goldsboro Expedition. It was a Union victory. 1864, the War of the Triple Alliance. Paraguay invades the Brazilian province of Mato Grosso, which is a massive jungle area where it said dinosaurs still roam. 1882, Henry Morton Stanley returns to Brussels from the Congo. He's the one to utter those immortal words, Dr. Livingstone, I presume. 1889, the American Academy of Political and Social Sciences organized in Philadelphia. 1897, revolutionary and first president of the Philippines, Emilio Aguinaldo, signs the Pact of Biak-Nabato. It ends hostilities and dissolves his government. In return, he got amnesty and 800,000 Mexican dollars as an indemnity. That wasn't bad. 1900, France and Italy signed a secret agreement by which Italy recognizes France's right to exploit Morocco in return for France conceding Italy had the same right to exploit Tripoli. 1913, on this date, Greece formally takes possession of Crete. 1914, President Woodrow Wilson signs the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act. It's designed to regulate and tax production, importation, and distribution of opiates and cocoa products. In 1916, America's first board-certified doctors are named by the American Board of Ophthalmology following an examination at the University of Tennessee Medical School in Memphis, Tennessee. Well, let's see what else we got. 1918, Sinn Féin candidates win 73 of 105 RS seats in the UK general election. All refused to take the seats in Westminster, instead meeting at a Dáil Éireann in Dublin. 1927, Iraq gains independence from Britain, but British troops remain all the same. 1933, dancer, singer, spy, and civil rights activist Josephine Baker performs in Amsterdam on this date. 1934, the first streamlined steam locomotive introduced in Albany, New York. 1941, Winston Churchill travels to the U.S. on board the HMS Duke of York. 1941, U-557 torpedoes British cruiser Galatea. 1941, Japan and Thailand sign a treaty of alliance. 1944, the beginning of Lease Aktion. Germany tries to recruit Dutch men for the German labor force. That same year, Congress establishes the rank of General of the Army. 5 stars. 1944, German occupiers forbid the use of electricity in parts of Holland. 1946, Togo was made a trusteeship territory of the UN. It was also in 46, the UN General Assembly voted to establish the UN headquarters in New York City. 1947, the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, we call it NASCAR, is founded in Daytona Beach, Florida. 1950, the UN General Assembly establishes the High Commission for Refugees. I talked about NASCAR being founded on this date in 1947. 1950, UN General Assembly establishes a High Commissioner for Refugees and wins the Nobel Peace Prize in 1954. 1952, KROD-TV, Channel 4 in El Paso, Texas, begins broadcasting. It's now known as KDBC. 1952, UN troops kill 82 North Korean POWs during a prison camp riot in Panggam-do, South Korea. 1955, the Tappan Zee Bridge in New York opens to traffic. 1961, Jimmy Dean's Big Bad John is the first country song to get a gold record. And in other sports news, 1963, Vern Gagne beats the Crusher in Minneapolis to become the National Wrestling Association champion. Such small things, legends are made. Alrighty, we've been talking about the strange and the unusual. But how about a case involving a missing corpse? In the Huguenot Museum at Cape Town, South Africa, is a tombstone bearing the name of a young man who warned authorities they might take his life, but they couldn't keep his body. And events proved him to be absolutely correct. As Father Dupree entered his cell, the prisoner in the death cell in Cape Province prison stood up. There were two soldiers guarding the door. The condemned man reached out and took the Bible from the priest and said, "This is my book and my life. I lived by it. And I swear before God I didn't kill Pierre Verrier. I go to my death an innocent man." Well, the priest put his hands on the boy's shoulder and said, "I believe you, but they've decided you have to be hung in the morning." A moment later, the governor of the Cape Province Penitentiary stepped into the cell and read the formal document that reminded the doomed man that he, John Gebhardt, had been sentenced to hang for the murder of Pierre Verrier, a farm laborer who had been convicted of strangling. And then the governor asked the young man, did he have anything else to say? And he said, "Yeah, I'm innocent." On that bright morning in November 1856, John Gebhardt walked the short distance to the gallows with a firm step. Still without visible emotion beside the noose that would soon snuff out his life, his father Dupree started to read the customary burial service. Gebhardt turned to him and said, "Don't bother to waste your time. They may destroy this body of mine, but they can't kill my soul." Well, at that point, the executioner slipped a heavy noose over the prisoner's head and pulled the knot up behind his ear. He only had seconds left to live. Twisted his head around in the black hood and said, "No grave will hold me." "I'm telling you, there's no grave that's going to hold me. You can't keep me in a grave because I die an innocent man." Well, at that moment, the trap was released and John Gebhardt swung off into eternity. About 2 hours later, after the necessary medical examination and legal determination he was dead, as decreed by law, his body was put in a plain black coffin. Well, because of the widespread attention this particular case had attracted, authorities at the prison made doubly sure the coffin lid was heavily nailed into place. Alrighty. Well, as I said, they made doubly sure the coffin lid was nailed down tightly. And then the prison guards put it on a cart to be buried on the slopes of the Paral Mountain behind the prison. They dug the grave 8 feet deep, covered it with stones. In accordance with the instructions from the governor, armed guards stood watch over the grave day and night for 2 months. They're going to thwart any attempts to remove the body. Well, there were other events going on that were to give this particular case a new turn. At the farm where John Gebhardt had been accused of killing Pierre Villiers, the owner discovered the purse of the murder victim in the possession of one of the ranch hands, Peter Lorenz. When Lorenz tried to run, he was caught and held for police. When they searched his bunk, they also found the ring and watch that belonged to the dead man. Lorenz subsequently babbled out his confession. He had murdered Villiers. He'd been the principal witness whose testimony put the rope around the neck of John Gebhardt. So there had indeed been a tragic miscarriage. All righty. This Peter Lorenz turned out to be the murderer, as well as the principal witness against the man that was wrongly convicted. Now, John Gebhardt had gone to the gallows for a crime he didn't commit. So the governor of the province of Good Hope ordered Gebhardt's name cleared of the crime and an immediate payment of £1,000 to the widowed mother of the unjustly executed man. And for the rest of her life, she was to get a pension of £108 a year, which for that time period was not a shabby amount. Governor also ordered the body of John Gebhardt to be exhumed and reburied in consecrated ground at the expense of the government. Well, Ms. Gebhardt accompanied the official group that climbed the slopes of Parole Mountain to the spot where her son had been buried only 2 months before. She stood by as the soldiers removed the stones and the earth and finally brought the coffin to the surface. Prison governor examined the coffin, found the seals all in order. Guards pried open the lid and surprise, surprise, the coffin was empty. Subsequent official investigations discovered his grave had not gone unguarded for a moment during the period between his burial and the discovery his coffin was empty. The government dug up scores of other graves in the vicinity, all without result. But Gebhardt's body couldn't be found. About a century later, in August of 1956, some picnickers found a heavy black marble slab high up on the slopes of the mountain. He's lying face down, covered with writing. According to the inscription, sacred to the memory of John Gebhardt, blessed are they that rest in the Lord. Well, that slab is now in the museum at Pearl in Cape Town. Lasting reminder of John Gebhardt's claim that no grave would hold him because he was innocent. And he was telling the truth. Well, you know, most television audiences are well familiar with the performance given by people who are introduced as having so-called photographic minds. People who glance at the pages of books and magazines and then describe the contents page by page. So is it a fraud or is it true? The incredible powers of the human mind are demonstrated in many ways. The well-documented ability to defy time and space through the act of dreaming, the ability to reason to the extent of studying the mind itself, the ability to separate the conscious mind from the unconscious, the well-known but little understood ability to function as a fantastically retentive storehouse and, in some cases, as a calculating machine. Somewhere in this complex of remarkable endowments lies the explanation of the television performers with the photographic minds. It's there. But thus far, no scientist has been able to explain it beyond reiterating the well-known fact that the subconscious mind forgets little or nothing. It remains only to develop the ability to recall from the subconscious to be able to perform amazing feats of memory. Maybe the best-known case of this fabulous ability to memorize was the Rabbi Elijah of Vilna, a Lithuanian who regarded his strange mental power as a curse. During his lifetime, he read and memorized at one reading more than 2,000 volumes. At will, he could recall any page and any portion of any page in any of these books. From his viewpoint, the ability was undesirable because he was able to forget anything he'd read. It was, according to him, like living in a library all day and taking it to bed with you at night. Then the renowned French statesman, Léon Gambetta, was endowed with a remarkable memory comparable to that of Rabbi Elijah. Gambetta could repeat verbatim thousands of pages of the works of Victor Hugo, and he could repeat the works forward or backward, beginning at any desired point in the volume. Famous Greek scholar Richard Porson shared this unusual ability to the extent that he was able to quote page after page from almost any book he'd ever read. It was another amazingly retentive memory that enabled Harry Nelson Pillsbury to win for himself the title of American Chess Wizard. His uncanny ability to remember the precise location of every chess man on as many as 20 boards at a time, plus the ability to recall more than 1,000 moves that he had been made, enabled him to play as many as 20 blindfolded games simultaneously. Sometimes, just to relieve the tedium of the chess match, he'd play a blindfold game of cards at the same time as the chess matches. Maturin Vissier, who was the librarian to the King of Persia, had an incredible memory for sound. After once hearing a sentence spoken in any language, he could repeat the sentence with the proper pronunciation and the original accent. One particular test of his powers, 12 foreign emissaries, each speaking a different language, delivered 12 sentences, which he heard, and when they had finished, he repeated it back to them correctly. The ability to perform prodigious mathematical feats mentally is a rare but well-documented endowment of persons known as human calculating machines. After one such marvel was a retiring chap by the name of Zerah Colburn of Vermont. As a child, he attracted attention by his surprising proclivity to solve involved mathematical problems in his mind. At the age of 8, he was taken to London, where the learned men might observe at close range this gifted young man. They put him through intensive tests, which only left him more baffled than ever, because Colburn didn't even know the rules of simple arithmetic, but he unhesitatingly gave him almost instantaneous answers to such problems as that of extracting the cube root of 268, 336, 125, while at the same time he was raising 8 to the 16th power. Well, during his test in London, he was asked by the Duke of Gloucester to explain the method by which he had just multiplied 21,735 by 543, and the youngster promptly replied, "I simply multiplied 65,205 by 181. Now, he had the correct answer, but like the puzzled professors, he couldn't explain the process. When Jedediah Buxton dallied on his problems for hours or months, Johann Martin Dace delivered the answers in seconds or minutes. Born in Hamburg in 1824, he was considered so reliable that scientists of his day often asked Dace to solve their involved astronomical computations. He once multiplied a number of 100 digits by a similar number in 9 minutes. And that's about twice as fast as the modern electronic brains can do the same job. If to prove anything else, the careers of these prodigies proved that the human mind is a wonderland of incredible capabilities, little understood and largely unexplained. Well, you might think it takes a genius to do something like that, but how about a genius in revolt? You know, a life story that ranges from being a genius at 4 to being a failure at 40 was the story of William Sidis. And strangest of all, he was a failure by choice. At the age of 2, he could read high school textbooks. Logical stage development for a youngster being able to select any letter of the alphabet when he was only 6 months old. On his fourth birthday, under orders from his father, he wrote two 500-word treatises, one in French and the other in English. A year later, while the father beamed with pride at this genius he had shaped, little William Sidis observed his birthday with another mental milestone. He wrote a treatise on anatomy. Professor Boris Sidis took the treatise to Harvard to show his learned colleagues what his remarkable child had accomplished, and they were properly surprised when the child still had another marvel in store for him. He revealed that he had worked out a method of calculating the day of the week on which any day had fallen. His method worked, too, as far back as 10,000 years. Scholars were determined to prove he was incorrect and found out he was absolutely correct. By the time he was 10, he had written a textbook on geometry, and he had written it in Greek. At 11, he was a student at Harvard. He had qualified 2 years earlier, but the authorities at the university felt he should wait a little bit before actually enrolling. A genius at 2, a failure at 20. You have to ask yourself what happened. The chronological sequence of events in his life gives as many clues as you could ask for, but no definitive answer. Boris Sidis taught abnormal psychology at Harvard. He's known as the brilliant author of several volumes dealing with the subject he taught, and well-remembered as an honored member of the Harvard staff. Well, he made a fateful decision shortly prior to the arrival of his son. He decided to put some of his theories on mental development to the test by using his own child as the guinea pig. In this method, he managed to ruin two lives. It was the father's contention the brain could be developed just as muscles are developed, getting an early start and forcing the workload. When little William arrived, his future was figuratively perched on the edge of his crib. The father suspended the letters of the alphabet on strings over the baby's bed, and several times each day he showed the letters to the infant, calling out their names as he did so. And this continued hour after hour, day after day. So, small wonder that by the time he was 6 months old, he could identify the letters. Well, that was a major issue. And none of the silly nursery rhymes was the child exposed to. That's according to the father. Instead, the child was bombarded every day with textbooks. Geography, geometry, physiology, and Greek were the daily fare of this hapless youngster. He permitted no playmates. His world was a prefabricated playhouse of the abstruse. Month by month, his incredible mental development continued to the amazement of his father's colleagues and to the bewilderment of his mother. Brilliant as he was, the elder Sidis had a serious blind spot. By the time his child was 8 years old, he had developed a strange habit of giggling at inappropriate moments. That was a hysterical reaction that popped out when a child was involved in the weightiest of mental problems. And it was a sign of disaster the father absolutely refused to recognize. At the high point of this program of forced mental feeding was reached when William was 14. That was the day he took the lecture rostrum at Harvard discourse to the learned men of 1912 on the fourth dimension. As he concluded his speech, with their applause ringing in his ears, the teenage genius turned from the lecturer, giggling hysterically and uncontrollably. Well, after a lengthy stay at a sanitarium at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, the boy came back to Harvard and graduated with honors. He told newsmen all he wanted of life was a chance to live a normal existence. William Sidis had called a halt on his father's experiment. Became a member of Rice Institute in Houston, only to learn he didn't know how to get along with people. Both in and out of school, they shunned him. Now in full revolt against his father and the world, he was convicted of inciting a May Day riot and drew an 18-month suspended sentence. For months, he simply vanished. Until an old friend of his father's came across the young man clerking in a store under an assumed name for the large sum of $23 a week. From the heights of genius, he sank to the skid roads of society. Under persistent pressure from an old acquaintance, Sidious agreed to make a public address on the subject of possible life on Mars. Instead, he discoursed on more than an hour, interrupted by fits of giggling, on the subject of streetcar transfers. In summer of 1944, World War took little notice of the unkempt man who died of pneumonia in a Brookline boarding house. Substantial inheritance from his father gone untouched. To the bitter end, genius William Sidious refused to touch the money of his parents that had ruined his mind. You know, the interesting thing was he was and continued to be a genius. He just refused to use it. Well, you know, there are historically, as I said yesterday, giants and little people. And they well may be indigenous to this planet, but one of the world's tiniest mummies and one of the archaeologists' biggest mysteries revolve around the mummy of a man only 14 inches tall and so ancient no counterpart's ever been found. Now, scientists from far and near have examined this tiny fellow and have gone away amazed. He's absolutely unlike anything they ever saw before. Sitting there on a shelf in Casper, Wyoming, visible, disturbing evidence that science may have overlooked him and his kind much too long. It was October 1932 when a couple of gold prospectors were working in a gulch at the base of the Pedro Mountains about 60 miles west of Casper. They found some color in the solid stone wall of the gulch and set an extra heavy charge to rip deeper into the stone to get at the gold. When the blast opened a small natural cave in the solid granite, the cave was no more than 4 feet wide, 4 feet high, and maybe 15 feet deep. When the smoke and dust had settled, the miners got down and peered into the opening and got the shock of their lives. Because sitting there, looking right back at him, was the tiny mummy of a man-like creature. He was sitting on a little ledge, legs crossed, sitting on his feet, arms folded in his lap. Dark brown, deeply wrinkled, had a face that almost monkey-like in some respects. One eye had a definite droop, as though the strange little fellow might be winking at those that found him. One of the prospectors carefully picked him up, wrapped him in a blanket, and headed back for Casper. Of course, the news of their discovery attracted considerable attention. Scientists were skeptical but interested. According to conventional archaeology, it would be impossible for a living being to be entombed in solid granite. But there he was, in defiance of orthodoxy. Maybe it wasn't a living creature. Maybe it was a hoax. X-rays would tell, of course. And an X-ray did tell. It showed unmistakably this was a creature that had been a man or man-like. Its tiny skull, the vertebrae of its spine, the rib cage, the bones of the arms and legs were all readily discernible. The little fellow had been about 14 inches taller than life. Mummified, he weighed about 12 ounces. His features developed an overall bronze-like hue. Forehead was low, the nose flat with widespread nostrils, the mouth wide with thin twisted lips set in a sort of a half-grin. X-rays showed he had a full set of teeth. Biologists who examined it declared the creature was about 65 years old at the time it died. But the question became, when did it die? Nobody knows, and no scientist so far has ventured an opinion. The Anthropological Department of Harvard says there's no doubt that it's a genuine mummy, Dr. Henry Shapiro, head of the Anthropology Department at the American Museum of Natural History, said the x-rays revealed a very small skeletal structure covered by dried skin. Obviously, it's extremely old, historically speaking, and of unknown type and origin. This mystery mummy, according to Shapiro, is much smaller than any human types now known to man. So is it the body of a mummified infant? Anthropologists who've examined it are of the opinion that whatever it is full grown at the time it died. Curator of the Boston Museum Egyptian Department examined the creature and declared that it had the appearance of an Egyptian mummy, which hadn't been wrapped to prevent exposure to the air. Another expert, Dr. Henry Fairfield, ventured the supposition the mystery mummy of the Pedro Mountain might be a form of anthropoid which roamed the North American continent about the time of the Pliocene age. You know, it was natural that the cave itself should be subjected to careful investigation. Scientists found no traces of any human residence there, no artifacts, no carving, no writings, nothing but the tiny stone ledge on which the mummy had been sitting for countless ages. Possibly he was a remarkable curiosity even in his own time and among his own kind, whoever that may have been. Nature occasionally turns out some very small specimens, and this creature may have been one. Early human and unbelievable miniature. Possibly held in awe by his fellows for that reason. This might account for his unusual internment by a race that ordinarily treated its dead with somewhat less attention. The only other mummified midgets discovered in this country was a red-headed mummy found on a ledge in Mammoth Cave, Kentucky in the 1920s. This was a run about 3 feet tall, which showed signs of being only a few hundred years dead, so to speak. The mystery mummy of the Pedro Mountain has never been explained, may never be, because he presents the experts with some possibilities at variance with their accepted theories, and scientists do not like to vary from their belief in how the world is supposed to be. They're quite content to leave him on display in Casper, Wyoming, unexplained relic of the dawn of man. Well, you know, sometimes it appears things are cursed. In this particular case, we're going to be talking about a cursed car. And it was certainly an elaborate automobile. And it figured in the deaths of 20 million people before fate finally caught up with it. It was a bright red 6-passenger touring car. It had been driven less than 200 miles when it carried two members of royalty to their tragic rendezvous. In fact, the car had been built especially for their service when they visited the tiny Bosnian capital, Sarajevo. It was June 28, 1914. And the political situation throughout Europe was certainly explosive at the time. All that was needed was a spark to touch off the war that was just waiting for an excuse. Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife, the Duchess of Hohenberg, entered the brand new bright red phaeton to drive through the streets of Sarajevo. And for some reason that's never been explained, they didn't even turn back when a bomb was thrown at their car. It struck the side and bounced back into the street. The explosion injured four members of the Archduke's staff who were riding horseback behind the car. After stopping to see the injured were cared for, the royal couple went on to their tour of the small city. Then we have another unexplained factor. Their driver, who was thoroughly familiar with the city, left the prearranged route and drove the bright red car into a dead-end street. When it arrived there, a young man waving a pistol and shouting maledictions sprang out of a doorway on the narrow street, jumped on the running board of the car, fired shot after shot at point-blank range into the bodies of the Archduke and the Duchess. By the time the astounded guards could beat the assassin to the cobblestones, the royal couple were dead. Well, this murder was the spark that touched off World War I, with a total loss of 20 million lives. Behind the cataclysm, the evil red car continued to blight the lives of those who came in contact with it. A week after the war broke out in Europe, General Podoryak, distinguished commander of the 5th Austrian Corps, entered
seized the governor's house in Sarajevo, and with it he came into possession of the car. Well, he didn't have long to wait for the curse to operate once again. 21 days later, he suffered a catastrophic defeat at Valjevo, lost his command, was sent back to Vienna, where he became an impoverished lunatic who eventually died in the almshouse. At this point, the red car was taken over by another Austrian, a captain who'd been on the ill-fated Podiorek's staff. Well, the curse acted quickly in regard to the captain. Driving at high speed, he struck and killed two Croatian peasants, swerved into a tree, and was dead when the troops removed him from the wreck. He'd had the car 9 whole days. After the armistice, the newly appointed governor of Yugoslavia became the owner of the car. He ordered it restored to first-class condition. In the first 4 months he had it, he was involved in 4 accidents. In the 4th accident, he lost his right arm. Well, at that point, the governor ordered the car destroyed. Its evil reputation was well known, and it seemed unlikely anybody would want to drive it again. But, amazingly, his prospect appeared. A Dr. Circus, he laughed at the thought of a curse, bought the car for virtually nothing, couldn't secure a chauffeur, so he decided to drive himself. For the first 6 months he had it, he was ecstatic. And results seemed to support his contention that the curse was nothing more than a figment of the public imagination. And one morning, the car was found upside down beside the road, only slightly damaged. The doctor's dead body was lying beside it. He'd been crushed to death when the car rolled over him. Well, the doctor's widow sold the car to a wealthy jeweler who enjoyed it for a year till he committed suicide. The next owner was another doctor whose patients deserted him, fearful of the curse of the car. So he sold it on to a Swiss race driver in a road race in the Dolomites, where it threw him over a stone wall to his death. Well, after that, it was obtained by a well-to-do farmer near Sarajevo. Had it repaired and drove it without incident for months. And one morning, it stopped on the road. He induced a passing farmer to tie it on behind his cart and tow him back to the city. When they had scarcely started, the car roared into power, knocked the cart and horses aside, and careened down the road, overturned on a sharp bend, and killed its owner. But its grisly trail was coming to an end. The battered red car was bought by Tiber Hirschfeld, a garage owner, who repaired it and painted it blue. Well, because of its history, he wasn't able to sell it, so he drove it himself. One day, when he was taking 6 friends to a wedding, he tried to pass another car at high speed. Hirschfeld and 4 companions were killed in the ensuing accident. Well, this time, the car was rebuilt at government expense and sent to a Vienna museum. All in all, it had killed 16 people immediately, helped start one world war, and remained for another war to destroy it. Allied bombs ended the curse of the red car during World War II, during a bombing run. Well, you know, sometimes there are places that just look odd. And this particular place, the moment you see it, something tells you nature's gone mad. If you're on horseback, the horse will shy away from it. Birds will swing around in flight and dart away to less disturbing areas. Even the trees give the impression they're under the influence of a power they can't escape. Because within that strange circle of gravitational insanity, the tree limbs droop noticeably and the trees themselves lean toward the magnetic north, although the trees around them point straight up. This is the world-famous Oregon Vortex. Lies along the banks of the Sardine Creek, about 30 miles from Grants Pass, Oregon. What it does is well known, but why and how has never been answered. The vortex is approximately 165 feet in diameter. I don't know if they're circular in shape. But instruments indicate that the exact size of the tormented zone varies slightly from time to time at 90-day intervals. Within the circle is an old wooden shed, once an SA office, but abandoned back about 1890 when the scales began to play tricks. At that point in time, the building was uphill, about 40 feet outside the limits of the vortex. After the shack was abandoned, for some reason, that portion of the hill slid down to its present position. Now, the building itself is warped and twisted, whether by the unknown forces of the vortex or from the strain of sliding down a hill is a matter of conjecture. When you step inside the old building, you're in another world of some sort. You feel a tremendous pull downward, as though gravity had suddenly been intensified. You instinctively lean at an angle of about 10 degrees toward the center of the circle. If you lean backward, that is, toward the outside of the circle, you have the creepy feeling of being pulled toward its center. And instruments indicate, in fact, you are. Well, many scientists have conducted lengthy experiments at the vortex trying to unravel its riddle. They hung a 28-pound steel ball on a chain from a beam in the old shack. Visitors can see this ball apparently hanging at an angle, defying the laws of gravity. It dangles perceptibly toward the center of the circle. You can easily push it in that direction, but it's more difficult to push it toward the rim of the circle. Even cigarette smoke is affected by the weird forces within the vortex. A puff of smoke blown into the still air within the shack will begin to spiral faster and faster until it vanishes. Some of the uncanny antics that startle the tourists include such experiments as placing an empty glass jar on a sloping board and watching it roll uphill. A ball, even a child's sponge rubber ball, placed on the level spot on the earth near the edge of the circle, invariably rolls slowly toward the center. A handful of tiny paper scraps tossed into the air will spiral madly about as though stirred in midair by an unseen hand. It's a creepy sensation in an eerie setting. This remote woodland glade where nature seems to have gone mad was known to the Indians, who solemnly assured the early white settlers the place was cursed. Pale faces had to be shown, though, and having been shown, they had to investigate, and they're still doing it to this day. So the question becomes, is it merely an optical illusion accompanied by vivid imagination? Instruments have been used that measured the outer limits of the disturbance to determine the size of the circles, roughly 165 feet across. Other instruments were carefully set up beyond the influence of the vortex itself. By sighting through the planes of these devices, it's easy to establish that the feeling of standing at an angle within the circle was not imaginary. By the same method, it was easy to prove that the 28-pound steel ball suspended from the chain inside the shack actually does hang at an angle toward the center of the vortex. Golf clubs, brooms, and other odds and ends of that general configuration are easy to stand on and end inside the confines of the circle. In order to be balanced, they have to be leaned at a measurable angle away from the center of the vortex. Well, the phenomena that accompanies the vortex forces is demonstrably electromagnetic in character. Ordinary photographer's light meter, which converts light into electricity and registered it on a dial, will show that wide variations between the daylight inside the circle and that outside the circle. Compasses simply refuse to function. The world-famed Oregon vortex is similar in some respects to another spot about 45 miles away in the Siskiyou Mountains, although the phenomenon of the vortex is much more profound. At Camp Birch, Colorado, still another magnetic sink seems to operate, again less powerful than the vortex. The force is there. It's measurable. But what is it, and why is it? Nobody knows. The Oregon vortex is indeed the oddest and maybe the craziest place on Earth, other than the House of Representatives. Well, we come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow, and once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.